I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. The focus at last week's International Summit on Human Gene Editing in Washington, D.C., was some new breakthrough research techniques involving editing genes in human embryos, sperm, and eggs. And while it offers the potential to prevent and treat inheritable diseases, conference organizers decided it would be irresponsible to proceed with any clinical use of germline editing unless and until safety and efficacy issues were resolved and there was societal support for the procedure. That's pretty much a quote from the conference. So today on Radio Times, why the excitement and why the concern? And we have two guests who have joined us. Joining us from the studios of Princeton University is Jennifer Kahn, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. In fact, wrote a piece about this new research in the November issue of the New York Times Magazine. And she has taught in the magazine program at the University of California, Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism and a visiting lecturer at Stanford University as well. And Jennifer Kahn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks much, Marty.
Also with us and here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Jonathan Moreno. He's a professor of medical ethics and health policy, also a professor of history and sociology of science and of philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, has a particular interest in stem cell research, end-of-life ethics, science policy, and neuroethics. And Jonathan Moreno, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Jennifer, let me begin with you, and only because I spent yesterday afternoon reading your articles and a whole bunch of articles about this new gene editing. And I feel the need for our listeners to make sure we all know what we are talking about. When we say gene editing, what do we mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the funny thing is we've been able to edit genes for a while now, actually since 1974. But we were pretty bad at it. I think that's what most people don't realize was how hard it was to do. And what makes this new technology, you know, which is kind of just called CRISPR, shorthand is CRISPR, really remarkable is that it's so efficient, so fast, so cheap, and so easy that – and it works in basically every kind of organism and cell type. You can edit pretty much anything. And what we mean by edit is, you know, our DNA has like 6 billion sort of letters in it, all these little base pairs. And if you want to change a gene in there, take it out. If you want to change even an individual base pair, one of these pairs of letters, you can now change that with CRISPR.
And the idea is that CRISPR, and it stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. Do I have that right, Jennifer?
You do, yeah.
Whatever that means. But I guess why this is so much in the news is that it is so much better at editing genes, therefore raising a whole host of questions about its use and even the ethical considerations.
See, that's the thing. You know, every time we develop a new technology, of course, you know, there's all this hand-wringing about, you know, what might happen now? So when gene editing first came in, people thought, oh, my gosh, it's opening the door to these, you know, designer babies and everything else. And we might actually finally be reaching that point.
Wow.
It's not quite that simple, but that's what is exciting and I think for some people also frightening about CRISPR is that, you know, historically we've kind of been very alarmed when a technology emerges and then it turns out it's not quite as simple as we thought. But with CRISPR, we might really be getting there.
Well, just one more question then. I do want to get Jonathan Moreno in on the conversation. I mean, we edit here on radio. So when you're talking about gene editing, I mean, in the old days, we used to use a razor blade. Now we can do it digitally. But when we're talking about editing genes then, it's just – what is the procedure, Jennifer?
Yeah. So CRISPR is basically like a word processor for genes. You can delete a little patch. You can delete a word. You can delete multiple words, whatever you want. And the way it works just roughly is that there's a gene actually called CRISPR that codes for this protein. It creates a protein. And that protein is capable of cutting both strands of the DNA at a very precise spot. It's guided by an RNA called a guide RNA that directs it to exactly where the researcher wants it to go. And then it binds on and then it cuts it. And so you can choose exactly where you want it to go just the way you'd put a cursor on your Word document.
And how do you see this developing new evolving technology, Jonathan Moreno?
Well, as Jennifer says, we've been sort of at this for about 40 years, and it's very interesting that it just happens that this is the 40th anniversary of a famous meeting at the Asilomar Conference Center in California when the leading biologists in the field of the new field, recombinant DNA research, got together and decided to have a moratorium for a number of reasons, and especially what they were concerned about was as Jennifer sort of alluded to this, a big public reaction,
right.
A lot of kind of moral panic about what this meant. And maybe the most important thing they did besides show that there could be new biosafety measures to control what happens in the lab was just to reassure the public that the scientific community is capable of disciplining itself. And I think that was, to a very great extent, the purpose of the conference last week in Washington.
And do you think the community can police itself when it comes to this gene editing?
Yeah, I do. And now, of course, I'm a little biased because exactly 10 years ago, I co-chaired a committee at the National Academies on embryonic stem cell research. And we that committee established some standards for the scientific community that were immediately embraced not only in the U.S., but in much of the rest of the world as well. So, yes, I think it can be done.
Are you, though, concerned at all? Because if we're talking about editing thinking about editing things at its most sort of basic life form, we are talking about the possibility of affecting inheritance, are we not?
Yeah. I mean, there are two ways of doing this. One is through body cells, and there are a lot of issues about that, but that doesn't raise the kind of moral concerns for the most part that people have about editing the genes of very simple embryos. Mm-hmm. And there you do get into these very interesting questions about whether we should be able to, in a very deliberate way, manipulate our genetic inheritance and that of all our descendants. So, yeah, that's the big issue that was not the only issue by any means that was of concern at the conference last week, but it was one of them.
Well, I wonder, too, and I'll go back to you, Jennifer Kahn, which is we know a little bit about gene therapy. How is this different from gene therapy?
Yeah, well, interestingly, as Jonathan was saying, it's actually both. So gene therapy, in theory, can be helped by CRISPR because you can create exactly the change you want. And so that's actually expected to be one of the first human applications of the CRISPR technology. There's all kinds of what are called monogenic diseases. There's a single typo, basically, in our genetic sequence that just happens to have devastating consequences. So that could be sickle cell anemia. It could be cystic fibrosis. And so what that means is that in an adult, you can take some cells out and fix the mutation and then kind of put them back in.
Wow.
And I think there's actually a trial for a genetic form of blindness that they're now going to be able to make people see again, hopefully. The challenge, of course, is that gene therapy has, getting the cells out, fixing them is one thing. Putting them back in and having them proliferate is a separate problem. So that's not fixed by CRISPR. The second thing is what Jonathan was talking about, this germline editing. And that is basically where we take an embryo when it's still just this, it's sort of this single cell. And when we change the DNA there, that means that, every copy of the cell in that child is going to have that altered DNA, and then their children are going to have that DNA. And so that's where things get interesting.
Well, indeed. And I guess that's where there's some concern. I mean, on the one hand, if you could make sure that people didn't get sickle cell anemia or some of these other, as you call them, monogenic diseases, that would be a good thing, wouldn't it, Jonathan Moreno?
Oh, it would be a good thing. And you could not only in principle, eliminate the certain susceptibility to diseases. You could eliminate the carriage of diseases from one generation to another. However, the genome isn't in many ways a living thing. And when you change one piece, you may have effects on other pieces that are hard to predict or impossible to predict, in part because only a few percent of our genes code for proteins. Most of what our genome seems to do is regulate our reaction to things that happen to us in the environment. That's called epigenetics.
Right.
And so it becomes a little unclear about what the long-term implications are of taking one thing or modifying one thing in a line of descendants. That's just the safety issue. the bigger philosophical question about whether human beings should be engaged in that kind of activity at all is really separate from that one.
But I mean, what you're saying is there's really, let's say people go ahead with this and they actually use it. There might be these sort of what, unintended consequences that we cannot predict?
There could be. And then there are objections from people who worry on one hand about the dignity of the human germline and also from the justice side, some people get to modify in a very deliberate way their offspring and all of their descendants, and other people don't because, you know, you follow the money. Some people have access to this and some people don't. There are also many countries, by the way, in which this is already by treaty against the rules. You can't – in many countries you're not allowed to modify the germline for anything but medical reasons.
We'll talk about money. Jennifer, in your piece in the New York Times Magazine, it seems like there's gold in them hills. There's money in this technology, yes?
Oh, yeah, it's enormous. I mean, honestly, everyone wants to talk about this kind of the germline editing. Can we make these, you know, custom boutique babies? And that's very exciting. You know, there's all kinds of things that are largely genetic that you think, you know, well, what if I could choose to have a child with perfect pitch? Oddly, that's genetic. It gets very tantalizing. But honestly, the big money is probably in a lot of other stuff. One of the things that does apply to us is sort of disease research and drug development, because the way that a lot of that currently works is that when they try to find the genetic causes of heart disease risk or diabetes risk, they do what's called a genome-wide association study, which means they basically sequence the genomes of a big batch of people who are at high risk and try to see which genetic variations they have in common, which sounds like it should totally work. But the problem is that out of, you know, all these genes we have, healthy people typically have more than a couple million random variations that are just natural variation in people. And so when they look at all the variants that this group shares, they basically get a bunch of noise. You know, some of the genes they identify might be really important, but a bunch might be minor or irrelevant. Some of them might be caused by the disease, and that's why the people share them. And in the past, it was so hard to, you know, change a gene in the lab that there was no way to test each of these variations to see which one mattered. But now with CRISPR, you can test that. So it's radically going to improve our understanding of which genes matter and how, you know, which ones to target with a new drug.
And we're almost up on a break here, Jennifer, but it seems like there's almost no way to put this quote-unquote genie back in the bottle, right? I mean, the technology is here. The people are moving ahead on it. People are interested in investing in it. So gene editing is the brave new world is here?
You know, I think so. I think what really worries the scientists is that sometimes these technologies come and they get embraced, and sometimes they don't. You know, the folks who worked on genetically modified crops, you know, really see that. There is an enormous division around there. You know, people are still afraid of these tomatoes that have a flounder gene in them or whatever it is. You know, they don't want to eat them, even if they've been proved, you know, scientifically safe. So I think the social question, the societal support is really what they're concerned about.
Well, I do want to pick up on that. That's Jennifer Kahn. She's a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. In fact, wrote about gene editing in a recent edition of the magazine. Also with us is Jonathan Moreno. He's a bioethicist at the University of Pennsylvania. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're talking about something that was a pretty big topic of conversation at a meeting in Washington, D.C. last week. Some new techniques in gene editing showing some promise for preventing and treating inherited diseases. Our guest, Jennifer Kahn, has been writing about this, had a recent article in the New York Times Magazine. And she has taught magazine writing at UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, also a visiting lecturer at Stanford. Jonathan Moreno here with us in our Philadelphia studio, professor of medical ethics and health policy, also of history and sociology of science and of philosophy at the University of Pennsylvania. He was at this conference last week. And you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I do want to talk about food because I think people, it feels like it's more a part of our lives than some of the things that we have been talking about. But to you, Jonathan, I mean, can you imagine maybe in not too distant future that people would use this technology in order to do the kind of enhancements that Jennifer was talking about?
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if a very few people did elect to do that with one-celled embryo in a fertility clinic. A lot more money in IVF, by the way, if that happens. Although I think it will not be common. And, of course, you can't be always sure that the perfect pitch gene or the stature gene is going to work out as planned. And there are other ways of selecting embryos in the fertility clinic that are not affected by a heritable disorder through preimplantation and genetic diagnosis. So my guess is that this will not be a very common procedure, but I think some people will probably elect it in jurisdictions where they're allowed to.
Well, does that raise bioethical concerns for you? Or if someone wants to do this, it's their body, their life, their child, that they should be allowed to?
Well, we do tend to default in this society to reproductive freedom, and I think it's not impossible to prevent it. But it may be something that the authorities decide just isn't worth trying to prevent because it happens in so few cases.
Oh. Jennifer, I don't know if have you talked to bioethicists and others who are perhaps wrestling with some of the bioethical considerations involved in gene editing?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I almost think of it less in terms of ethics, all respect to Jonathan. Mm. It's more, one, there's obviously the actual safety issue, which they're working on. They have to make this technology incredibly good. So there's, none of these current off-target effects, like where they cuts it in the wrong place or something. You don't want to do that in something that's going to become a person.
Sure.
And then beyond that, I think it's almost more about the social acceptance of the risk, because it's one thing everyone always talks about stuff like, could you give your kid golden eyes or make them tall to be a basketball player or whatever. But there's other stuff that you could do. What if you could, as you could, tweak one gene and make your child resistant to HIV or potentially less vulnerable to Alzheimer's? So there's actually a lot of very legitimate reasons to do this kind of editing that I think most parents actually would want for their child. I think it's just complicated because of everything, Jonathan has said. These genes have multiple functions that we don't often understand perfectly yet. And in other cases, we're certainly not omniscient. Like the sickle cell mutation is a really interesting case. Two copies give you the disease. One copy helps you resist malaria.
Ah.
So in some cases, by preventing one risk, we may inadvertently make ourselves more vulnerable to another in a way that we don't even recognize yet.
You're nodding your head, Jonathan.
Yes, the Tay-Sachs example also with Tay-Sachs and tuberculosis seems to be an association there. A number of the scientists who spoke last week at the summit in Washington stated that they thought that the so-called target problems were going to be solved, that they were only engineering issues, and also noted that, for example, if you wanted to confer protection against HIV susceptibility to your child, you could do that, again, somatically rather than the germline. Mm. So I think all this does, again, narrow the reasons for doing stuff in the human germline.
But it does raise questions, for parents particularly. I mean, if you want to create and raise a healthy child and some of this technology is available and it has some of the promise that people have been talking about, it does seem rather compelling, John.
It does. And, take the example of Huntington's disease, 50-50, right? What's called a dominant disorder. So one of the scientists last week, Rudy Janisch from MIT, pointed out that because we're talking about a single cell embryo, a zygote, you can't go in at the moment, at least, and pull stuff out of that strand of DNA to test it. So, if you're going to do the modification, you're doing the modification potentially also on a so-called wild type or normal piece of chromosome.
Right.
So you can't tell right now, and that raises very interesting questions, obviously, about what kind of risk we might want to take with so-called normal embryos.
Jennifer, let me go back to you. And actually, the woman that you write about in your piece, her last name is Doudna?
It's Doudna, yeah.
I mean, she seems like a fascinating person. Can you do a little mini profile of her for us?
Oh, sure. You know, one thing I'll confess I did like about this story, I studied physics back in the day and there weren't many lady physicists. And I appreciated that she discovered this with female co-collaborator, a fellow scientist. She actually grew up in Hawaii and, it was one of these people who just from the very start was fascinated by the natural world and not even the way that most kids are. She wasn't fascinated by the cute animals that hopped around in Hawaii or whatever. She was fascinated by the molecular kind of chains that drove behavior. So there's a plant, a species of mimosa, that if you stroke it, the leaves close up. She was fascinated by, like, what was the chemistry? What were the molecular forces that caused the leaf to fold up that way? So really from early childhood, she was someone who was fascinated by this sort of stuff.
Which maybe helps us understand why she was able to make such progress on this gene editing.
Oh, yeah. She actually – what's interesting is that she didn't even come from this field, really. She was an expert in RNA, which to many of us is a very kind of obscure field. It was for years thought of as just kind of this boring – handmaiden that DNA would, unzip and RNA would kind of take its instructions and ferry it over. And that was really all it did. And now we know that it's much more interesting and complicated. But so she started in this and then, it's really, in a funny way, it's quite a fluke. She met this woman who said, I think you should look at this gene, CRISPR. I think it's going to be interesting to you. And so then she started looking into it. And so I think a few people who'd been studying it for a long time, it put their noses a bit out of joint because, she sort of swooped in and figured out how to create this tool.
And it's interesting that three of the scientists on the first science panel last week, were women. Dr. Doudna, a female scientist from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York who had done some important work on one of the earlier gene editing systems in the 90s, and then Emmanuel Charpentier from Paris. And it was sort of interesting just in terms of the competitiveness among scientists who were, brilliant, fantastic, and very ambitious people. Those three people and several men on the stage, a couple of us were looking at each other smiling because they're being nice to each other, but they're all in competition for the Nobel Prize at this point.
Yeah. Well, I was wondering whether that was kind of in the background here because
they're very genteel and very polite, and they give each other credit, and they cite each other's work. But, the truth
is – just like women to do that.
Indeed.
But, it's interesting, too, going back to you, Jennifer, and this clearly is an outsider just reading your article, which is – discovery is so interesting because it seemed as if Doudna had these sort of outside eyes. She was able to look at it somehow differently and see the possibilities.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think people in the community have a kind of a difference of opinion. Some people think she really brought this kind of exceptional talent and clarity, that you're talking about, the outside eyes. Other people think that if it hadn't been her, someone would have found it relatively soon after because a lot of people were working toward it. So as a brief background, what folks knew going in, when she picked this up was that there had been this gene that was a mystery forever. It turned out that it was part of an immune system in bacteria, which amazed everybody because nobody thought bacteria had these adaptive immune systems that could store a memory of what viruses had attacked them because bacteria get sick just like we do. They get attacked by viruses. So it would store a little fragment of the virus DNA, and then the next time it was attacked by the same virus, it would fight it off. And it turns out that the CRISPR mechanism, just that cutting thing was sort of it was almost like a byproduct. It needed to be able to cut out little pieces and store them. And so they already knew that by the time she came in. She came in just before they figured out that it, proved that it was part of the immune system. So then she came in and sort of began looking at exactly how the mechanism worked and whether it could be made into a tool.
Yeah, I'm glad Jennifer mentioned that because it's really a cool natural history story, and it sort of, proves the old adage, there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, this is a highly conserved process that it turns out you can pull out and use for these other purposes at human will.
I mean, is this this is evolution at work, is it not?
It is, and it's just fantastic that people were able to come along and see what was going on and take it out of its historic role in the ecosystem. I think it's certainly true that Dr. Doudna came along at an important time and had an insight. and others did as well. And we see this repeatedly in the history of science. If Watson and Crick hadn't written that paper, we know that there were people breathing down their necks to publish that paper. The same was true for the isolation of human embryonic stem cells in 98. Jamie Thompson at Wisconsin, you know, got there first, but there are other people who are going to do that too. But you know, the truth is that some people manage to
–
somebody manages to crystallize things, and they deserve credit for that.
Well, we are talking about CRISPR gene editing, and that's Jonathan Moreno. He's a professor of medical ethics and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Jennifer Kahn joining us from the studios at Princeton University, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, wrote a fascinating story about this CRISPR and gene editing in the magazine just last month in November. And we have a couple of open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me pick up on a couple of things that you wrote, Jennifer. I know Jonathan wants to weigh in on this as well, which is the use of this gene editing when it comes to agriculture, pest and drought resistant crops. Are we talking GMOs here?
Right. So that's what's so interesting. Basically, in terms of terminology, it gets kind of complicated. So yes, we're modifying genes, so it's a genetically modified, you know, crop. But in the conventional sense of what a GMO crop is, no. So a genetically modified corn or tomato or whatever else is kind of defined by the fact that it's had a gene taken from usually something completely other, from a bacteria, from a fish, from a whatever. Yeah, I think tomatoes had the flounder gene put in them so they would resist frost better because flounders swim in cold water and somehow they had an evolutionary adaptation for that. And I think that's the main thing that weirded people out. So what CRISPR will do is it'll let us get away from all that stuff. And instead, you'll just be able to go in and basically do what crossbreeders have been trying to do for centuries, but very precisely. So instead of just having to slowly breed two different strains of wheat in hopes of optimizing one thing without causing other problems, we'll be able to go in and recognize, oh, gosh, if we just change this one spot – we can really improve the amount of vitamin A produced, or we can really make it less resistant to a particular disease.
Jonathan, you want to weigh? I mean, this is fascinating.
Yeah, actually. And so many people are anxious still about the salmon that the FDA finally approved right after 4 or 5 years of sitting on it. Took a gene from another animal and made this salmon grow twice as fast. But as Jennifer sort of suggests, will people see CRISPR-modified vegetables or animals in the same way as also genetically modified? So we do have GMO sub 1, GMO sub 2, you know, two different senses of genetic modification operating here. Makes it even more complicated for the consumer and for the labeling.
Well, I was thinking about labeling. I mean, labeling is important. People want to know what it is that they're buying and ingesting in this case.
They do. And, you know, and we haven't mentioned yet insects, right? So there's talk about going into mosquito populations and modifying them in such a way that you send out millions of mosquitoes that don't spread malaria. They're no longer the vector for malaria, which we're still not very good at taking care of because it's a parasite and it's a big problem in much of the developing world. That hasn't been done yet, but I, at the meeting last week, I was talking to a graduate student who told me that in northern New York State, moths whose babies die fast are already being released. Genetically modified moths, which I had not known about, because they tend to eat green leafy vegetables like kale. That's everybody in my family insists on eating, and which
it's
I can't escape in the. You know, I was just getting used to Brussels sprouts in every restaurant I go to. Now it's kale. So, kind of the agricultural options for insects are also very important.
Mm. Well, I'm thinking of the honeybee collapse. I mean, the idea that honeybees are really at risk of, I don't know, extinction or certainly something close to that.
And friends in government tell me that the president mentioned this a couple of years ago. And as soon as the president says, you know, what's going on with the honeybees? He's really concerned about this. Everybody starts freaking out, right, in the executive branch. And there is a bit there, but not making a joke about it. It is a big problem. Honeybees are an important part of the ecosystem.
Jennifer, let me go back to you and go back to the article you wrote, because you also talk about this technology, this technique used for things like biofuels, for detergent, for yogurt. I mean, it looks like, and it looks like there's money in here. So perhaps this will happen faster than it will with embryos.
Yeah. Oh, and it's actually already happening. I mean, that's it's actually fascinating how much of our economy is going to depend on genetically engineered things these days. Just anything that uses enzymes, paper processing, your laundry detergent that keeps your clothes soft, all those rely on enzymes that are produced by bacteria. And so if you can genetically modify those bacteria, I can guarantee you people are probably already doing it. And then beyond that, the biofuels question, you know, for a long time we've been trying to figure out how we can, for instance, modify bacteria to actually become little factories to turn things out. So they recently managed to do that with an anti-malarial drug actually called artemisinin. They managed to engineer bacteria to produce that drug, which was otherwise very expensive and sort of, you know, came from a fairly obscure source. And so a similar thing would apply to, you know, producing biofuels. What if you get bacteria just to generate this stuff so we didn't have to rely on petroleum the way we do now?
Are there struggles over labeling this stuff, Jennifer? GMO, you know, people see GMO on a package and many of them freak out.
Right. And, you know, I actually don't know. I mean, presumably there will be. It's much murkier, though, because, you know, it's one thing if you sort of say, well, gosh, you know, I want to know that this tomato has a flounder gene in it. Where you draw the line between a CRISPR-edited thing, like in theory, you can't even really tell very easily that there's just one little base pair maybe has been changed to tweak something. And some of them are – it's going to be very subtle, like I actually was just reading that some scientists managed to edit a gene in pigs, and they normally are really susceptible to African swine fever. It's sort of like Ebola for pigs, and it's devastating for farmers in sub-Saharan Africa. And they discovered that warthogs are actually pretty immune to that disease. And so if they can tweak the gene of the pigs so that they don't get it, it will really help a lot of these poor farmers.
Well, we have a lot of people that want to join the conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Talking with Jennifer Kahn, Jonathan Moreno, about gene editing, what's on the horizon, what is here. Much more after this very short break, and we'll begin taking calls as well. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with a bioethicist, Jonathan Moreno, and with journalist and writer Jennifer Kahn about gene editing, CRISPR. We've been talking a lot about that. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Just one quick thing, Jonathan, you wanted to say about modifying pigs, just to make sure everyone's sort of up to speed on what's going on here.
Well, as Jennifer was saying before the break, this stuff is so amazingly adaptable and flexible that some people are now talking about doing what people had hoped to do 30 years ago, using pigs as sources of organs for human beings who need them. It's called xenotransplantation. And there have been some technical problems with that. Now people believe that with something like CRISPR, you might be able to modify pigs so that their organs could be compatible with the tens of thousands of human beings who are waiting for them.
Wow. I mean, that just opens up a whole other world of discussion. Let me get James from, looks like Mount Airy, to join the conversation. And James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a biological anthropology student over at Temple University.
Sure.
And studying primates especially, it seems that we engage in a lot of selective breeding as it is. And how do you define the difference between what we do already and, you know, anticipating what our offspring will look like and actually editing potential offspring through something like CRISPR?
And James, that's a great question. I heard a laugh from you, Jennifer. I'm going to toss that to you first, which is, you know, we do in certain ways engage in our own selective breeding.
Yeah, you know, I'm laughing only because I feel like, you know, that's what I think gets overlooked is we have been doing this for a long time, less with ourselves, you know, more with animals and plants. But I think that's the question, is how much society really is going to feel comfortable embracing it. Obviously, with something like CRISPR, we can do it in a much more deliberate, much more targeted way. But I think what people don't always realize is that we've been kind of subject to a bunch of random variations before this, and they haven't always been very helpful for us. And so now if we can get a bit more control over it, it's alarming. You know, there's sort of the plague god fear, but you know, otherwise you're really kind of at the hand of a fairly random fate. And so, you know, I don't know how society is going to feel about that.
Yeah, I don't either. Go ahead, John.
Well, there's a theologian named Joe Fletcher who 50 years ago coined the term the genetic lottery, and he was hoping that in light of decoding the genome and the double helix that we would be able finally as human beings to take ourselves out of what he called the genetic lottery. And he's a theologian. Others, of course, responded very negatively and critically to that idea. You know, mate selection is a great example of how we do unconsciously help to decide what kinds of children we're going to have. That's part of the evolutionary process. It happens in singles bars all the time, I'm told. So in a way, we have been doing this even with human beings. At the same time, you know, when does quantity of intervention become quality? Are we at a tipping point, as it were, right, where the precision and the role of the laboratory in doing these things really changes what we've been doing in normal mating for eons?
A tweet from Liz, so related to what we're talking about, RE gene perfection, yes, likely appealing to wealthy parents, so the Ivy League legacy doesn't always pan out, though. And I remember a story a couple of years ago about the sperm of Nobel Prize winners or some kind of, egghead.
There was a Nobel sperm bank, although apparently there was only one actual Nobel laureate in the sperm bank. And apparently none of it was ever actually used.
Oh, interesting. So, but the idea of it.
Well, the idea of it is what it is. The truth is that, you know, you can have some genetic material from a very smart, attractive person, and the next person that comes out of that is not so smart and attractive.
And I will also throw in that complicated traits like intelligence are a lot farther off. You know, something that you can tweak a single gene to make a kid taller, that's one thing. But intelligence, you know, boy, there's surely thousands of genes involved in that. That's a made up number, but it's not going to be a simple thing of tweaking one gene and suddenly having, you know, someone who's owning Harvard Law School.
Or even schizophrenia, which was an example that came up in a talk by Eric Lander, an MIT geneticist, last week. There's dozens of genes involved in schizophrenia. Right. There's probably only a few that have a really strong signal, and those could be candidates.
Right. But you were talking, or we were talking earlier about sickle cell anemia, that there are some medical conditions that are single gene
related.
Related.
Yeah. And there's certainly, again, if people are able to, in financial sense, and have access, then people, I think, will choose to, if they're allowed to in their jurisdictions, to do that.
Let me see what Constance from Center City, Philadelphia has to say. Constance, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, hi.
Hi there.
I'm just calling because I'm aware that genes carry multiple expressions. And I'm just wondering if you eliminate the negative expression in a gene, what might happen to the positive ones? In other words, they would be eliminated too. And I'm speaking specifically here of schizophrenia because I am an identical twin, and my twin had schizophrenia. Uh-huh. And I don't think I came down with it, but I am very creative. I think I'm a writer. And I just feel that the human, there's a certain amount of egotism, I think, in the human nature that might suggest to them that they could do better than what nature has done. And that's a very serious question, I think.
It absolutely is a serious question. Constance, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jennifer, do you want to take a stab at that? And then Jonathan.
Yeah, I'd love to. So schizophrenia is a great example, as Jonathan was saying, actually. The evidence we have is that it's definitely not caused by just a single gene. It's caused by a variety, kind of a rotating cast of possible genes, different in different people sometimes, that somehow combine to create this condition. So again, it's not something that's one that's going to actually be tougher to just, fix. The thing that is good is that we weren't very good at studying it in the past. And one thing that CRISPR will really change is that we'll be able to build better primate models of these disorders, because we mostly could study only mice before because they were really easy to manipulate. But mice don't have a lot of the same brain structures we have, so they're not as good for studying something like schizophrenia. But if you can use a particular kind of primate that's very similar to a human, you might really be able to get a better understanding of the underlying roots of this disorder. And then maybe we can begin to think about how we might either, you know, fix it, you know, genetically, or just come up with better treatments for it. We might be able to come up with better drugs that actually work for more people.
Jonathan?
Well, of course, people with schizophrenia generally don't have the ability to express their creativity. And that's one of the many tragic things about this, one of the most terrible diseases there is. Mm-hmm. But we've kind of been in this debate before, not with genetics, but so much with drugs. Remember when Listening to Prozac was published, and this question of people who were very emotionally labile, you know, really great artists, perhaps maybe somebody like Van Gogh, for example, if they were to take Prozac, would they be so leveled out that they wouldn't be able to express their genius because they wouldn't have the highs and the lows? You know, that's something that we've talked about before, not with genetics, but with drugs. And that to me is really imponderable. I mean, how much would we, you know, as a society, be willing to give up to have people like Van Gogh more stabilized in their emotional lives?
Well, and interestingly, Constance talked about doing better. I mean, in certain ways, isn't that evolution is about, I guess, perfecting to some degree our genes or perhaps the environment. I mean, the idea of doing better seems to be sort of built into our psychology. We want better for our children, for instance.
Oh, we do indeed. One of the things that I'm hearing a lot from my neuroscience colleagues as well as the geneticists is that it's surprising how well modulated we are. In that evolution has had millions of years to do experiments with us.
Yes.
And it really is pretty tough to enhance, to get beyond some kind of physiological norm as compared to doing therapy. And we're seeing that. I must say, I follow the neuroscience very closely. I follow the genetics. And we're seeing that again and again and again, that it's very hard to reliably do a lot better on the whole than evolution does on the average.
You see it that way, Jennifer?
You know, I actually don't really know. I'll say that I certainly agree. There's been that kind of argument for a long time that evolution does a fair amount of optimization. But there's also kind of a counter argument that it really happens fairly randomly. So it doesn't happen in a targeted, directed way. So we've been around for a long time, but that doesn't mean that, you know, everything that's best for us has been selected for. A lot of things happen kind of accidentally. So if we can identify, you know, and combine things that give us particular strengths, abilities, or disease resistance, I don't know. We might actually be able to beat out evolution.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, though, that the technical obstacles to doing enhancements, both genetically and in terms of pharmaceuticals, have turned out to be a little harder than people thought.
Let me see what Will from Wayne has to say. Will, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. You kind of just touched on this, but I was looking for more extreme enhancements. If this is a gateway to something even almost transhuman, if we could see in the ultraviolet spectrum, or we could be better adapted to accept prosthetics, or if we encounter new environments, if we could be better adapted, if we could be engineered to be better suited to those places, say if we decided to move underwater, which we might have to.
That's an interesting comment, Will. Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure my transhumanist friends are very interested in what's going on right now with CRISPR. But I think they would also say there are other shorter-term ways to do these things through mechanical interventions, through things like transcranial stimulation. So it might not be the first thing that you would think of.
But it is interesting. I mean, it does open up some of it might be science fiction, some just sort of fun to contemplate. The idea, Jennifer, of I guess adapting to different kind of environments, like living underwater, we become those flounders, and then we get put in tomatoes, right?
Yeah, and honestly, you know, I really don't know how close we are to that, but I will say it actually came up. I was listening to that the summit that happened this past weekend, and someone actually brought up the example of, you know, well, what if we could see in the ultraviolet? What if we could see in the infrared, see at night? You know, and actually the scientist who brought it up said, that'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, it would be.
You know, so.
Well, and one of the questions that I stumbled upon in doing some of the homework, and this is to you, Jonathan, which is on the ethical front, whether it's, you know, unethical to do this or whether it's ethical to do this. I mean, the question is, you know, when you add it all up, is it the right thing to do to move forward on it, or is it the right thing to sort of hold back and say, you know, we cannot proceed beyond this point?
Well, the safety issues will be the first ones that people worry about. And if you can get over the safety issues, then I think you get into – and of course, the efficacy questions, that which will take a long time to resolve in many of these areas.
Right.
Then I think you get into the bigger sort of social philosophical questions. And I agree with Jennifer that this is a big societal-wide decision that ultimately may have to be made.
Let me get Suzanne from looks like Reading to join us. Suzanne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm just wondering, has this research kind of superseded or taken the place of what I understood epigenetics to be, and that is trying to find out what makes a gene express? I mean, just because there is something in a gene, it's the environment that I thought the new research had shown in the last 40 or so years that enables the gene to express. And so I'm just wondering where this focus,
sure,
you know, what the difference is and whether this is kind of taking the place of that.
No, it's a good question, Suzanne. Can I toss that to you, Jonathan?
Yeah, well, this is sort of part of that. You can use these editing technologies to figure out what genes express what traits. So this is all part of that. It's not superseding it, not replacing it.
And it's not either or, is it?
And it's not either or. No, it's a vastly greater refinement over the techniques that people have had in the laboratory for the last 40 or 50 years.
You want to weigh in on that, Jennifer, at all?
No, I basically agree. It hasn't superseded. There's sort of two separate areas. There are the genes themselves, and then there's these kind of volume controls on the genes that turn them up or down. But, you know, who knows? CRISPR actually may end up being very useful for understanding more about these epigenetics, or even maybe eventually controlling them.
We have an email from Jill. Says, I'm a breast cancer survivor that carries the BRCA gene. I would love to hear what the experts have to say about editing for the BRCA gene. Can you jump in on that, Jennifer?
Yeah, that was actually a specific one that Jennifer Doudna brought up to me. She said that she's gotten letters from women saying, how can I make sure I don't pass this on to my children? And you know, that's a really good example. So it's my guess is that for the foreseeable future, really, we'll probably still be using pre-implantation genetic screening, basically, to prevent, you know, most of these kind of conditions that are heritable. You can just screen the embryos. It's much easier and safer, and then just choose the ones without the mutation. But there is this real question of, you know, wouldn't it be great if you could just rid this from a person's germline forever? Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's one of the promises of CRISPR.
Yeah. Jonathan?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It's down the line, perhaps. But in the short run, you're still going to want to go with the more familiar, available, and safer techniques.
We're doing this show because of the conference that was held, and it got a fair amount of attention. Where do you think, Jonathan, so where does this go next?
Well, the organizing committee, headed by Dr. David Baltimore, said at the end of the meeting that it would be inappropriate to proceed with human germline editing, and they made some other remarks about some of the other uses of CRISPR technology. But the fact is that the National Academies have appointed a 19-member committee of scientists and ethicists to look at this over the next year. So the final report isn't out yet, but I think it'll probably resemble very much what the organizing committee concluded.
Well, I learned a lot, and I really appreciate both of you joining us today on Radio Times. Jonathan Moreno, thanks for coming back on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And Jennifer Kahn, thank you for joining us from the studios of Princeton University.
Thank you, Marty. It was such a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, listen to us on satellite radio, get our newsletter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, always an adventure here on Radio Times. And the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.